Welcome to Never Overnight, where the focus is the struggle, the success, and the story in between. My name is Benad Jacob, and I'm your host. If you're a fan of this podcast, remember to subscribe, rate, and share with your friends by searching Never Overnight wherever you stream your podcast from. In today's conversation, I talk with Maju Varghese. Maju is the Chief Operating Officer of the National Endowment for Democracy and has previously served as a key senior White House staff member for both the Obama and Biden administrations. We talk about his upbringing, his journey through the White House, and many important lessons he's learned along the way. Maju has experienced struggle, success, and this is his story. Maju, welcome to the podcast, man.
Thanks for having me, man. It's good to see you again.
We actually first met December of 2018. I was on a panel. I was hosting the panel, and you're one of the folks on the panel. And I never hosted a panel before that day. I absolutely need advice, and I, of course, came to you first. And I was like, I have no idea how to host a panel. Let me, like, what are key pointers that you have? And you said, when I get nervous, just look right at you. And I took that to heart. I maybe stared at you too often in that panel. So I do apologize for that.
No, it's all good, man. You did great. You're natural, obviously. And that was the before times, man. That was,
yeah.
That's a long time ago.
Even though that was like 5 years ago, it really feels like it was like 10 years ago, considering how 2020 itself felt like 5 years.
Wow. Yeah.
But first, let's dive into kind of your upbringing, right? So I found out that your mom worked as a nurse, your dad worked as a cab driver and a security guard of a hospital. So before we dive into who you are, let's talk about them real quick. And how did either or both play a role in who you are today?
Yeah, absolutely. And quietly, I don't think we realized it at the time, but our parents were teaching us things. And, you know, my parents were grinders, right? They got up, they went to work, they worked tough hours, night shifts. My dad would drive a cab late at night. They were really tough New York City at the time, 70s and 80s, crime was really high. My mom would work nights, evenings. And like, sometimes it was just a handoff, like, you know, one of them would come home and the other one would leave. And when I think about that now, like, I'm home with my wife, we're gonna have dinner, like, you know, they didn't have that all the time. And that was just how they did it. But I think quietly, they were teaching us the value of like working hard and doing what you got to do and making the most of your opportunity. My weekends were spent with them where at church. And I remember being like, oh, got to go to church. Like, we're going to be there for hours. But what were they showing me quietly and things that I still care about, like value of community and friendship? It's all still there. I mean, I find myself sometimes doing and saying things and being like, oh my God, I sound like my dad. I sound like my mom. But it's there. Being raised in an immigrant family, like first generation, like there, that is a unique thing.
And speaking of growing up, did you realize from a young age that you were meant to do what you're doing now, or was it like an experience or an engagement that you had with someone that made you realize, hey, I can go into this field?
A little bit of both, right? So one thing we grew up in my house with was like my parents had the news on 24/7. I would come home from school, whatever, and the local news would play for an hour, and then World News Tonight would play for another half hour. And that was just like my soundtrack, right? And then they would kick a Malayalam movie on after dinner. But like that was the soundtrack of my childhood. And I was paying attention to current events and politics, and I knew stuff. And I remember even going to school and talking to people and or teachers would ask, like, hey, does anyone know what's going on in this election or whatever? And I would raise my hand. Some of the kids were like, how do you even know? I'm like, it's on all day. Like, of course I know. But I kind of got drawn in to wanting to understand it more and wanting to be a part of it. And, you know, I wanted to, you know, maybe work for a senator or work for a congressman or run for office myself someday. And I was like, maybe I want to be a lawyer. Maybe I want to go to law school. And I figured, you know, so studied political science in college and went to law school, not thinking like, where's this all going to go? Big picture. But that I was just exposed so much. And I was curious about that field and curious about politics and government and governing and electoral politics. And like, I thought it was fascinating to watch and observe in our community, especially at that time. You were really extending yourself if you didn't want to be a doctor. Like, there weren't a lot of other paths. Being a lawyer was like, well, we don't have a lot of those. And so when I got the opportunity to do it, I got into it. You know, it changed my life.
Doing something different that wasn't like the doctor or engineer, did you experience any type of struggle going into in the early parts of your career?
I mean, my parents, I got to say, like, were super supportive, right?
Right.
Plus, they saw my math and science grades too, man. They were like, this dude, you know? I think the struggle is like when, and I think even at the time, like, I didn't have anyone to really go to say, like, what do I do here? I mean, eventually, as you get older, you start meeting people and networking and stuff. But like, I didn't have like an immediate role model in my community that I'm like, oh, that person did it or he or she did it. I didn't have that. But otherwise, like, I felt total support at home. I didn't have like just any awkward conversation about it.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel like your career when you started practicing as a lawyer, how did you feel like that prepared you for the role at like the White House?
So I was a junior or senior in college, and I knew I was going to go to law school, but I knew I didn't want to go to law school right away. Like, I was like, I did my 4 years here and like the immediate, you know, take the LSAT, go right to law school. That's seven straight years of school. And I don't know why, but I was like, I think I want to work for a couple of years. And a friend of mine that I went to school with interned in the Clinton White House. So this is the 90s. And he came back from interning one semester, and he was like, listen, guys, like, the 2000 presidential campaign's around the corner. The vice president, that time Vice President Gore, is running for president, obviously. They're staffing up the campaign. We were going to school in Massachusetts. The New Hampshire primary is the first primary. Why don't you guys come up with me? You know, you can help out on some events and on a trip and meet some people. And so I did. And it went really well. And I got hired. I got a job on the campaign. So that was going to be my, like, hey, let me do something between law school and college. And it opened up a whole other world though, right? I met people, I kind of started to create this little network of people that would go on to do really interesting things. I met my wife on that campaign. A lot of good comes out of that. That was really kind of where I got a taste in reality, not just like watching it from afar, but in it. And so, you know, we did the campaign, we lost the campaign, and I worked in DC for a little while, applied to law school, got married, went to school. But that group of people that I worked with on the 2000 campaign some of them stayed in electoral politics. Some of them went on to work for other candidates, and I would help them out from time to time, and I would do some stuff. So I kind of always had one foot back in that world. And so when President Obama ran for president in 2007, 2008, a couple of my friends were on the campaign. They asked us to help out on some of his trips around the country. And I thought this guy was phenomenal. He was like no other person I had ever seen as a public figure. Like, I could not relate to anyone the way I could relate to him. He was young. He was raising a young family. They were just paying off their law school loans. They were raising young children. He didn't come from much. Mrs. Obama didn't come from much. There was something about them that spoke to me, I'm sure, like, obviously spoke to a lot of people. And the opportunity to like help out on that campaign and help him get elected was a real lure. And then once they won, you know, an opportunity opened up to serve in the White House. So I would say, you know, my prior campaign advance work experience around the country was helpful, but also just like that network of people that had now kind of gone with him also opened that door with me, building a reputation with them, being a reliable, good person to be around and a good person to work with. Reputation matters. And I guess that stuck too. And so that door opened and I jumped in it.
One thing you said about the campaign when you first started, you said you got into and experienced the reality of it. And it's rare for people to experience the reality of a campaign, right? It's more common to watch it and observe it. So when you got into that, what is the difference between the reality and the perception of it in your experiences?
Sure. You know, I mean, look, we glamorize everything, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was hard work. You know, I was working long hours. I was not making much money. I remember I showed my parents my first paycheck and my mom put in some kind of stipend or something. But, you know, so it's the grind. It's the long hours. It's, you know, working weekends and late nights, kind of putting the rest of your life on hold. So that was real. And then also I experienced highs and lows. You know, we won the nomination and like that was great, but we lost the general in a disputed recount that hadn't been seen in generations. And of course I had to, you know, was in the middle of that too. And so I experienced defeat and what it was like to be unemployed when it was over and to have to look for a job and sort of like pick yourself up again. And that was a struggle and that was hard. That was a hard lesson that like, this doesn't always end the way you want it to.
And how do you overcome that type of defeat? Like knowing that, you know, like it's not only over, but everyone sees that it's over, you know, right? It's just like, how do you overcome that? Because that sounds like a mental hurdle that's tough.
You know, it's hard. It was hard. And you're right, because everyone knows. So yeah, your friends are calling. Sorry, what are you going to do now? My parents are like, oh, no. But I got to say, they were super understanding. But the good thing is you've got this network of in a community of people that you worked with that are also going through it too. So that was helpful. And having friends and family that were super supportive and like we thought it was win or lose, that it was an incredible opportunity. And, you know, and there weren't a lot of only other kids running around doing that. And I think that was, people were still proud to say that that was going on. So, and you know, I was only 23 or whatever when this is over, right? So this was my really first real job. Now I'm out of that job. And so now you're looking to find the next thing. And, you know, you get humbled, right? Because, you know, like doors are closing on you, or, you know, you get that final interview and you don't get the job. Like, you know, I remember going up to Capitol Hill because I made enough contacts and connections to get interviews. But I remember being told like, hey, you don't have enough experience, or we're hiring internally, or, you know, we're going in another direction. And that was humbling. Like, it was a tough time. You know, and that, you know, kind of like picking up the pieces and picking up your ego off the floor a little bit. And like the world could be a little humbling sometimes. It can teach you something. And it wasn't the worst lesson in the world, but in the moment, it was tough.
When you got into the White House eventually, you became a trailblazer in our community, you know, and given only a handful of Indian Americans have held a senior position at the House. How did it feel to be a trailblazer? Because you mentioned earlier when you started all this, you had no one to go to. But now you're kind of setting the trail for yourself, right? So how did it feel to be that trailblazer?
You know, it's funny because in the moment, you know, and, you know, I was blessed. Like I had an amazing, amazing time. I had worked with phenomenal people and good bosses who kept giving me opportunities.
Yeah.
But I think at the time, what would strike me is like we'd have interns who were not only Indian Americans, but like of all backgrounds, who would come to you and say, hey, how did you do this? And want to talk. And then like random people were reaching out, or in our community even too, getting outreach from people. I didn't realize until then, like what it meant to people. At some point in my White House tenure, this first time around with Obama, I spoke to the intern class, every class, and I would always tell my parents' story to launch before I started talking about everything else, because it was, to me, it was an opportunity, one, because I feel like we owe that to them, right? Like, I think to tell their story as much as possible. But two, it was my way of signaling to the room, there are people like me in this room, and you belong here. This is a good place for you to be. This is all possible. And then talk about, you know, the professional journey and everything. And I think that resonated, and I realized how much it did. The first time I did it, I never stopped after that, because people would come to me and they would say, they weren't always Indians. You know, they were like, hey, you know, my parents came from Haiti. My parents came from, you know, Malaysia. My parents came from China, wherever. They felt this real visceral connection to that story, because they were too, were like doing things their parents didn't think they could be doing, or their parents wanted them to go down a certain route and they weren't. And that this was kind of validation for them. It's possible. So I think it kind of hit me then.
Isn't it funny how like the common thread is our parents' stories, and all of a sudden there's a sense of ease, like, oh, you're a regular person too.
Yeah, 100%. You know, like I didn't go to Harvard or Yale, or, you know, I didn't grow up in this country with like any sort of like, you know, lineage or opportunity or family connection to any of this. Like this was completely foreign. I'm just like making it up, you know? But the interesting thing was how it was resonating to all types of people.
Now, did you feel a sense of pressure knowing that not many people around you look like you?
To be honest with you, I got to say, not entirely. I would tell you that the pressure is you want to make the most of it, right? Because you know there aren't a lot of people who've had this opportunity. Certainly, you know, knowing where you come from, you're like, I walk these halls every day. Like, I got to do this right. Not only do I have to like crush the jobs I'm given, but I got to do it with I got to carry myself a certain way. I got to treat people a certain way. I got to be a certain kind of boss. I got to be a certain kind of colleague, a certain kind of leader, right? Because I might be the first person that looks like me that some of these people will ever deal with or have ever dealt with in this way. And I want to make sure they understand where I'm coming from and that you know, that I'm representing like my family and that community the right way.
And you said right now you wanted to make the most of it. I think it's safe to say you did make the most of it, being a key member for two presidencies, holding several pivotal senior roles during that time. How do you feel like you're able to sustain and stand out in your career at the White House?
It's a good question. I think part of success is like understanding the technical side of your job, whatever that is. But the other is like the how, like how you carry, like I said, how you carry yourself, how you conduct yourself. And I think where maybe that I was given opportunity is people would see me and say, you know, we want him to do X. He's never done X before per se, but we think he's smart. We think he's kind. We think he shows leadership, shows initiative. People like working with him. Like we want him to take that culture and put it in another department or another office. I can say this about any field, right? Like whether it's IT or finance or whatever or the technical field you're in, that's halfway there, right? At some point, the technical skills start to matter a little bit less and your soft skills, your people skills, your communication skills, your ability to read a room, read people, under your EQ, that starts to matter a little bit more, right?
And
I think that is what I was learning. There's a real hunger for that, you know, in any professional setting for people who can understand the work, but also can understand the people side and the management side and the leadership side. Organizations are starved for that. I was always focused, and I say this to people now, and I sound like that guy, but like I always say, just crush the job you have. Don't speed it up. Don't speed that clock up too much. Like just take the thing you were given and do it so well that somebody's like, what? He or she's outgrowing their thing. Like in fact, there was a moment where my last job in the Obama White House, they asked me to run the management and admin department, which is essentially the COO of the White House office. And I was like, I'm good. I got a good team. I helped build some of it. I helped train some of it. I'm comfortable. And my boss at the time said, I know, now it's time for you to get a little uncomfortable. And I've not forgotten that. And I've given that same advice to people as I've asked them to take on more. That alone was a huge difference maker for me.
We had this conversation before we even started. We talked about how 2020 made the year felt like 3 years in one, right? And during that time, when the world changed due to the COVID-19 pandemic, and your role at that time at the White House involved working closely with a team of health advisors and the U.S. Surgeon General to develop safety protocols. So with that being said, did you feel a sense of pressure because of the unknown, considering the world has never faced this before, and what you're in charge of is really the entire country?
So March 2020, we're actually still in the middle of the campaign. And so it's March 2020. I was spending a significant amount of time in Philadelphia, which is where our HQ was. So spending some time away from home, you know, that's where I imagined I would be for several months. It's during the primary season. So it's pretty intense, essentially starting to clinch this thing. And then the pandemic hit.
Mm-hmm.
So we went from like the highest high at that point that we had since the campaign started to have to think about shutting down ops as we know it. I mean, presidential campaigns are inherently personal, right? Field organizers knocking on doors. It's candidates doing large events and shaking hands on a rope line and taking questions at a town hall and doing interviews and traveling. All of a sudden, we were like, we're in this new thing. And I remember it was March like 11th or so, and we were going to a meeting because we were lucky enough to have a series of advisors who were, you know, healthcare advisors, including Vivek Murthy, who is now the Surgeon General. And we were about to sit down with them and have a call to go over what to do. And I'm walking by a television set in campaign headquarters, and the NBA season was just canceled. Like, well, that's a multi-billion dollar operation with access to the best medical experts on the planet. And if they're going to call it a day, this is serious. And then we went into that meeting. It was only validated by the health advisors that said, guys, like, you got to think about sending people home. So it was totally the unknown because, one, we didn't know what that meant. Forget the campaign for a minute. Like, you know, you're starting to hear stories about people getting sick and infected. Having grown up in New York, a lot of my family were working in hospitals in New York. They were respiratory therapists, nurses. I was hearing stories from them about what they were starting to see. And I was like, okay, this is more than like whether we win or lose, which obviously that's what we're here to do. But like, are we going to be okay? Are people healthy? Like, and then, you know, staff start to, you know, get a what looked like a run of the mill cold. Is that what that is? Or is this the other thing? Like, now you're starting to ask all these questions. We've literally sent everyone home and everyone was working from home really for the remainder of the campaign. We loosened up a little bit in the summer and started traveling a little, but for the most part, it was the most unprecedented thing we'd ever been through. It was not what any of us signed up, obviously, for, but it was bigger than us, right? Like the interesting thing about presidential campaigns, I think the coolest part about presidential campaigns, but also one of the most stressful, is it doesn't happen in a vacuum. You're subject to whatever's going on in the world. World events shape the outcome. This was that on steroids. Yeah. The entire world was dealing with a generational pandemic that was taking people's lives, shutting businesses, you know, all of that. So it was scary. It was nerve-wracking. The good thing is, like, you have a goal, right? You're trying to get there. And so at some point, you just plow through and just try to find a way. And that's what we did. I spent a lot of time talking to doctors. Maybe it was my parents' way of getting back at me.
Yeah. And you left the White House January 2022, right?
Yep.
And this might be a really tough question to answer, but what do you feel like has been your proudest moment from your time serving at the White House? I know this is a many years to go through, but do you have a standout moment?
I mean, I have several. You know, at the end of the day, the campaigns are really a tool to get elected, to govern. And, you know, watching both those presidents do their jobs, pass legislation that changes people's lives, nominate diverse judges to the Supreme Court, have generational impact like that. I mean, that makes you proud. But I will also tell you that, you know, in the Obama administration, I think one of my favorite things to do was to bring my family through, come visit and do a tour. And I did it with all the aunts and uncles that could come and help people who have raised me and cousins. And obviously my mom, my dad had passed away, so he never got to do it, but that was a treat. And then the other treat was, like, you know, especially this time around, because the campaign was so hard, to walk the halls of this White House and to walk past, you know, some of our staff, especially our junior staff, like young staff who were on their first campaign. This was their first job, to see them working there and to see them walk in those halls and to see them doing their thing. That made me proud. The first time around, you know, I was in my 30s, but I was like my first time there. But I was looking at it from a different angle. I was watching these younger staff that I was their boss on the campaign, or watching them get their chance. That was always cool.
It almost sounded like you started seeing things as a proud parent.
Kind of, you know, and I, you know, I hate to date myself, man, but yes.
And during your time at the White House, did you learn anything about yourself that you did not know beforehand?
Oh yeah, a ton. You learn a little bit about what you're capable of.
Yeah.
It's a no fail job, right? Like, you've got to get it done. You know, when I was on the road doing advance work in the Obama years, you know, we would be on the road in a foreign country trying to pull a trip together, working with a host government, you know, coming down to the wire and trying to, like, negotiate some stuff to make the trip work, pulling things together, putting events together, and long hours, late nights, frustration. That plane's landed tomorrow, like, whether you want to do it or not. So you realize, like, how hard you can push yourself. I also learned a little bit about what I wanted to be as a boss and a leader. You know, you realize that it's not super complicated.
Yeah.
You realize, really, what is it that made you happy when you were early in your career? I just tried to replicate that, but I realized how simple it is. I mean, it's hard and to execute, but how simple that is. And leading through adversity, right? Like,
yeah,
you know, how to keep other people calm when you internally, your internal clock is going off. And you've got a lot of anxiety yourself, and you know, got a bunch of other things, but you can't project that. You know, you've got to project not ridiculous, stupid confidence, but like a little bit of confidence, like, we're going to be okay. You know, my team on the campaign still tells a story about the night we finished fifth in New Hampshire, and it's looking bleak. And the next morning I was at headquarters and I saw them all at their desks, and they looked so bummed, man. Like, and I could tell there was like a mood. And I pulled them all into a room, and they said they thought I was pulling them into a room to tell them that it was over and that I was letting them go. Instead, they said, "You looked us square in the eye," and they're like, "We love you for it, but we thought you were crazy. You said, we're going to win. We're going to win the whole damn thing. I think I might have dropped some other words in there too. And you guys are never going to regret doing this. And the night we won in November of 2020, it got thrown back at me a few times that, like, you know, but what I was trying to project was you're not in this alone. Like, we're in this together. And I learned that, I think, because I watched other people do it. And I watched what other people, what that means to people, even if they don't buy it all the way. Like, they're like, oh, this dude, I don't know, man. I think he's having some kind of midlife crisis or something. But what they did say is, like, you kept us calm when it was not. And you projected a good energy and a good vibe. Even if deep down, like, they doubted all everything I was saying.
Yeah.
It was like somebody was saying it.
Right.
The other thing I learned in the White House and on the campaigns and all that is the mission is one thing. But at the end of the day, the mission's only half of it. Like, if they work under you, they've got to feel a loyalty to you.
Yeah.
They've got to want to run through a wall for you. You're the ones asking them to stay late. And you're right. The one asking them to take that trip. And you're the one asking them to miss a family event because of some emergency. And if they don't feel it to you, the mission ain't enough. And that's something I learned too, that people taught me, was like, you got to have the buy-in as an individual leader, not just relying on them, you know, focused on the big picture.
In 2022, when you left the White House, you told CNN, one thing I learned during two tours here is that it is a demanding place to work. And because the work is really important, we throw all of ourselves into this. Right now, it's best for me and my family that I kind of just try to strike a little more balance. And that was in 2022. So I got to ask, how was the last year in striving for more balance been going for you?
It's going well. I mean, look, I work really hard.
Yeah.
You know, it's a big job and I work hard. There's nothing like, though, coming off of a long campaign, 14 months through the pandemic, running the inauguration through the pandemic and after January 6th. So that was another thing.
Yeah.
And then, you know, being in the White House that first year, running the White House military office, which is a pretty big operation and a lot of pressure on that, you realize, and look, there's just tread on the tires, right? Like, that's a lot. That's a lot to do. And you're just kind of going from one to the next. And I, you know, could I have kept going and done another year? I think at that point I was like, look, I just need to take a pause here and step off the treadmill and take a beat. And I tell you, one thing that it's given me is a little bit of clarity. I've had more time with my family, you know, a little bit more relaxed on the weekends, not waiting for a phone to ring, a little healthier, and just like a little mental clarity. Because honestly, even having this conversation opens up all the stuff that I don't think about or talk about that much. You know, that doesn't mean that I would never do something like that again, or that I would never serve again. But every once in a while, I think it's healthy to step off.
Did you feel a sense of clarity looking at things from the outside in instead of the inside out?
Oh yeah, 100%. Because when you're in it, you're in it. And like, that's your thing every day. You see things with blinders on. And stepping away, yeah, you learn about, man, like, maybe I would have handled something differently, or maybe I should have done X. And that was what bothered me about something. You just don't have that clarity in the moment. Like, you have to actually get away for a little while.
Considering everything that you've experienced in presidencies and where you are now, and do you feel as if you are successful?
Sure. If I sat down with my 23-year-old self, the guy that couldn't get a job and like had the doors closing, he would say I was. I think the other thing I always try to guard against is feeling too good about it. Right? Because what's the next thing? I don't want to always be known as the guy that worked for Obama and Biden. As awesome as it was, I want to do other things and see other things and figure out some more stuff about myself or growth.
That kind of opened up a question. If you could tell your younger self one sentence, what would that one sentence be?
It would be a two-part sentence. It would be slow down.
Mm-hmm.
Take life as it comes. Because I think we put pressure on ourselves to be quote unquote successful. And, but no one even knows what that means. Like, how do you define that? And so it's like, just do the thing that's in front of you. Try to make the best years the ones you're in now.
Yeah.
Don't look too far back. Don't look too far ahead. Just kind of be in the moment, live in the moment, and like take in what you can right now. That promotion, I know you want it, but maybe you're not ready. And maybe it's okay that you just crush what you're doing right now. And also, while you're crushing that, you're learning another thing, you're taking classes, you're doing, like, just kind of take it as it comes. And it's okay to fail once in a while, too.
This is a motivational podcast, right? So I bring on guests that focus on the success. We focus on the struggles that they have. We kind of just turn into a story. And the purpose of the story is to then turn it into motivation for other folks that are trying to make it in their industry or any industry, really. So what would be your advice to people who are aspiring to be the next Maju Varghese?
I think my first piece of advice is it's okay to have like a target, right? Like it's okay to see someone and be like, I want to be like that person, but just know that your journey is going to be yours. All I would say is like, take chances. We take for granted, I'm talking to you right now and I'm talking to you on a podcast, and in the industry you work in, like when I was growing up, guys weren't doing this, right? Right. Like a guy named Banaj had a radio show. Like what? Like, no, my head would have exploded. Right.
Yeah.
And then, but you're taking risks. And I think what I would encourage people to do, especially when you're younger in your career, to the extent that, you know, it's financially feasible or family situation, whatever. And I understand that, but like, don't be afraid at those moments of your career to challenge yourself and do the things that are harder and make you a little uncomfortable, whether that's leaving your hometown or a community or whatever. Don't be afraid to like push yourself out there, because you don't get the reward without taking the risks. And the other thing I would say is, if you're looking to be the next, I don't want to say the next me, but like similarly, it's not a linear path, right? There are going to be like fits and starts. You're going to hit walls. You're going to have to go around them. You're going to have to break through them. You're going to have to push through some hard stuff, but like have some personal like faith in yourself. Surround yourself with like really, really good people. And, you know, it's remarkable what you can do.
I asked only for one piece of advice and you just gave me an essay. So that's good.
Listen, I'm a father. my son's 17. When he asks me for things, I do this whole thing and he rolls his eyes. because I never have one piece of advice for him. I got lots. And listen, thanks for doing what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know, if this gets through to anybody, you know, in terms of like the message, and I've listened to your others, like the fact that you've got people on who are doing these like unconventional things.
Yeah.
Giving some things for someone to identify with, you know, kudos to you for doing this stuff, man. Like, and what you're doing, you know, you should be proud.
Thank you, man. I am. And moments like this is kind of makes me even more proud, you know? So once again, just thank you, Maju, for the conversation and just opening up your journey and with the audience. I really appreciate it, man.
All the best, Banaj, man. Stay in touch. All right.
Thank you, buddy.
If you enjoyed today's conversation, feel free to subscribe, rate, and share the podcast by searching Never Overnight on wherever you stream your podcast from. Thank you to Maju for sharing his story. My name is Banaj, and thank you for listening.